down. It's circulated orally with them, and it's their story of their tribe. They tell this story to one another, and this is the story that makes them who they are. Now, I'm not going to go into all the details of the story. I will tell you this. It's a pretty interesting thing, because here's what, in sum, happens in the story of the white buffalo calf woman. There are some braves out hunting, and over a hill comes a white buffalo calf, and it tumbles down the hill and becomes a woman who gives them the first ceremonial pipe and gives them something very close, she tells them, very close to the Ten Commandments, and says that there's somebody who will come later to tell them the rest of the story, and there will be a white buffalo calf, and she just returns and goes off into the sunset. Okay. Now, listen, I'm not going to go into all the details about this. There's some real things about, okay, what really happened in this? They have the pipe. I don't know. Okay, I'm not going to speculate about this. I don't know what else to say on this. But this is part of the constituted story of their tribe at this point. So I'm not saying it's true, false. That's not my point on this. But my point of it is that they have told this story through storytellers in their tribe for centuries and passed it down. Each storyteller can kind of riff on the story a little bit. There's things you can change in the story, but there's things you can't change in the story. And there's things in that story that if you change them, other people in the tribe or in the community will say, no, that's not how it goes. And a storyteller may even, as a fun thing to do with children, tell part of the story wrong to get the kids to correct him. Why? Because there's things you can't change in the story. Now, that's in our day. That's within the past few centuries, okay? That's happening right there. And this story was able to be preserved for centuries, changing very little as far as we know and as far as anybody can tell. Its story has gone for centuries and has been told and retold. So what I want us to see in that is this idea of telling a story and it going reliably is not an inconceivable idea, even today. And I can do, there are other tribes we could point to in that. So here's what happens in an oral culture, that is a culture where most people don't read and write. They learn to tell stories in ways that they pass them on from person to person reliably. Now, in the text we looked at this morning, there's a phrase in there where it says, what I received, I passed on to you. I hinted at that just a little bit this morning. There's a lot more to that. That is an indication of a tradition being passed on from generation to generation, to person to person to person. This is something we're not changing, okay? There's other ones of those in the New Testament as well. Probably most of the parts of the New Testament circulate in this way at some level among the people, and they start telling these stories to one another. So the first thing that Ehrman assumes that is wrong is that if stories are told repeatedly, they are going to be embellished, they are going to be changed. That only begins to happen, and sometimes doesn't even then, after the eyewitnesses are gone. I want us to understand that. That only happens after the eyewitnesses are gone. And as we see in the white buffalo calf woman story, that one there doesn't even always happen in those instances. But we see that it doesn't get extrapolated in that way and embellished and changed with reckless abandon necessarily just because they're telling stories by word of mouth. Secondly, Christian communities work together to keep the oral histories true to their sources. See, he uses the example of the telephone game. You've played the telephone game, haven't you? Okay? You have one person, they whisper to the next person, they whisper to the next person, and it starts out saying it's a rainy day, and at the end of the line it says, my teacher's hair looks like a mangy Wookiee's armpit, or something like that. I mean, you have this changes all the way around. But what I want you to understand is that's a terrible analogy, okay? Because of the fact that that's one person to one person to one person to one person to one person. You see the flaw in that analogy. The stories of Jesus were not primarily told one person to one person to one person. They were told in the context of a community, a church. And so everybody's hearing it. And so when you have everybody hearing the story, they are able to help correct. Imagine if you're playing that game and said, all right, I'm going to tell something up here, and then I want to tell everybody, tell me back what they heard. And so I say the story to somebody, and then they all are saying back what they heard. Well, you're going to get a much higher level of accuracy than one person to one person to one person to one person. Do you see that? It's a flawed analogy that he's using at that point. Now, eyewitnesses in the communities prevented fabrications and distortions of these oral histories, these stories of Jesus that are circulating. Here's what I mean by that. We know from several parts of Scripture, 1 Corinthians, Paul mentions that the apostles are traveling around. We have all these different reports of apostles traveling around. You may think, okay, what does this have to do with this? It has everything to do with this. There are only, at this time, according to sociologist Rodney Stark, who has done this, kind of extrapolated this data back, there are only around 7,000 Christians, at least in urban areas, in the entire world at this time, by the end of the first century. I want you to think about this. There's only about 10 times of your church in terms of what your attendance is, 10 to 12 times your church is all the Christians in the whole world at this time, at the end of the first century. Only around 7,000 Christians in the world, at least in urban areas. There might be more in rural areas, but in the urban centers where the church, where they were traveling. Now think about this. If you've got this clusters of people in cities and not that many, and you have eyewitnesses that are circulating and traveling in those, do you see how that's going to be a check and balance on this? Because if Peter shows up at your church and you're telling the story wrong, Peter can tell you, you got the story wrong. John shows up at your church, he's able to tell you that you've gotten the story wrong. If Paul, who has been with these apostles, even though he wasn't somebody who walked with Jesus, if Paul travels to your church and drops in and hears you telling the story wrong, he can correct you in terms of the story. And here's what's best of all in this. Every single one of the texts in our New Testament was written and finished before the eyewitnesses died out. That's important. That's crucial. About the last text written in the New Testament is probably John or Revelation that was written probably around the year 96, somewhere around the year 96, okay? And that's because there seem to be references to the persecution that came from Domitian in the book of Revelation, and his reign ended in the year 96, okay? So there seem to be some references to that in there. And so 96 is about the latest date it could be. Eyewitnesses are still alive at that time. John is still alive into the end of the end of the first century. We know this from a variety of sources. There's a guy named Papias who has actually collected a lot of these traditions, who was born in the first century and writes about them in the early second century. The eyewitnesses were all alive. Do you see that if the eyewitnesses were still alive when it gets written down and stabilized in written form, that there's a high likelihood that it was reported accurately and recorded accurately. Okay? I want us to understand and to see that eyewitnesses in the communities prevented these distortions and fabrications that he describes in this. That's what he's describing, is distortions and fabrications, and yet the presence of the eyewitnesses would have prevented that possibility. So in some ways, it was like the telephone game. In some ways. And here's why it's like the telephone game, even though I said it's a bad analogy, and it is. Here's what makes the telephone game fun. At least some people think it was fun. I hated it when I was a kid. I thought it was the dumbest game ever. That's why I probably still mock it to this day in these things. So, but here's what makes it fun, makes it work, is that at the end, the person who started the story is still there to tell what was happening, to tell what the original was. Well, what we have in the New Testament is that the person who started the story was still available and present. And so because the people who started the story, the apostles, were still available and present in the churches, when the story did get offline, it was able to be corrected. They were able to correct the story if it strayed from the truth. This is so crucial for us to understand this, to see this about these oral histories in the early church. So did the New Testament survive? Was it circulated at some level in this form? Sure, it was. But that should not make us afraid. It should make us actually confident, more confident than afraid. I also want to point out this. I mentioned this, hinted at this morning, but I'm going to go back in detail to it right now. Alexander the Great, okay? So I said this morning, I don't know of a lot of people who are saying, I just can't believe in that Alexander the Great guy. I mean, Maybe he didn't even exist. I mean, because there's such scant evidence. Nobody's saying that. Nobody's saying that, but I want you to say something. Alexander the Great, there were five accounts of his life written by eyewitnesses and one account written soon afterward. Now, at first, that sounds really good, doesn't it? Here's the problem. Not one of those accounts survives. None of them. Zero of these accounts survive. Now, we have later biographies that may have drawn from these texts because they had survived when the biographies were written, but none of these, not one of them survives to us. None of them survives except in fragments that are copied in much later works, and the earliest surviving account was written about 400 years after the time of Alexander the Great. Think about this. There are no texts about Alexander the Great that survive from any eyewitnesses. And yet, as I said, I don't hear anybody saying, I just don't think I can believe in Alexander the Great. Look at the life of Jesus. Four accounts written while eyewitnesses were still living. Early copies of all four accounts survive to this day. Survive to this very day. And as I showed you earlier, there are fragments of these that have survived from less than a century after the time of Jesus. Fragments of these very texts. You don't have anything like that for Alexander the Great, who was one of the great leaders of history. You don't have any accounts of his life that survive in the same way that we have accounts of the life of Jesus. Now I want to dig in a little bit deeper for a few moments to the text that we actually looked at this morning. The claim is that the books, that the texts in the New Testament, that the stories that were passed on, that those stories were recklessly changed and they were modified and they were embellished. Now, right here we have a good test case for this. Because Paul had been in Corinth 5 years earlier, okay? 5 years had passed when he writes this down since he was there. Now, what Paul says to them, and let's just pause for a moment. How was Paul's relationship going with the Corinthian church at this moment? It wasn't great. It wasn't great, okay? He's got to be careful. They're going to call him on anything he does that is wrong or that they perceive as being not completely above board. So Paul says to them, I passed on to you, when I was there before, I passed on to you what I also received. Now, pause for a moment. If Paul had changed this story, this tradition about Jesus, if he had embellished that, if he had recklessly changed it, as Ehrman suggests, how does he make sure that what he says here is exactly what he said then? Now, I guess the option is, Paul keeps a file folder, and he's like, oh, man, what did I do with that? What did I say in Corinth? Because I've changed it so much since then, and I've got to go back and find that file. Corinth, oh, that's what I told them before I changed it in Ephesus and before I changed it. Do you really think that's what happened? I don't think so. Paul could write this and say, this is what I said then, because he's not changing it. He's not changing it. He's saying exactly in Corinth what he says in Ephesus. He's saying exactly in Ephesus what he says in Rome. He's saying in Rome what he says in Asia Minor. He's saying the same truths everywhere he goes. He's not embellishing it. He's not recklessly changing it. As I pointed out this morning, even if this is all we had that's true, there would be everything we need to believe in Jesus. There's everything we need there. Now, praise God, we do have more. But if that's all we had, there's enough. Notice there is a, let's work through this. I passed on you what I received, that the Messiah died on behalf of our sins according to the Scriptures. There's an affirmation of the truth of the Old Testament there, right there. And that he was buried, and that he rose again on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he was seen by Cephas. Why? Why does he call Peter Cephas? Cephas is Peter's Aramaic name. And he's repeating a tradition and not even changing it over to go from Cephas to Peter. But why does he do that? First off, you see he's not wanting to change the wording that he received. But secondly, you see something else. There's only one place in the entire Roman Empire that they speak Aramaic, and that's in Galilee, Jerusalem, Judea, that area. We've just geographically identified where this came from because of the fact that this verbiage of Cephas, which is the Aramaic word for Peter, not the Greek word, is in the tradition. That almost certainly it comes from Judea, Galilee, that region there. Then the 12, then he was seen by more than 500 brothers at once, and then he was seen by James, and then by all the apostles. See that? Now, this is one little test case, but it's a useful test case because we know that Paul was there twice so he could refer back to previously. What we see in this is that it seems unlikely that Paul was changing what he received. It's highly unlikely that Paul, at least, was changing what he received. Now, so here's what I think we can say. That there is good evidence for saying that when these truths circulated by word of mouth, they were not changing them. They were not changing them. Let's go into the second skeptical claim. The Gospels that came to be included in the New Testament were all written anonymously. In my Bible, they're not anonymous, are they? But there's some truth to what he's saying, in that there are manuscripts that it seems like, don't have any titles on them. We'll talk about that later. When Christians recognized the need for apostolic authorities, they attributed these books to apostles, Matthew and John, and close companions of apostles. Scholars continue to call these books Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as a matter of convenience. They have to be called something, and it doesn't make much sense to call them George, Fred, Jim, and Sam. Okay, let's unpack this. Because I think the reasonable response is that Gospels were written by known authors whose testimony was traceable to eyewitnesses. I want to call him out on one thing he claims right here that surely he knows better on this at some level. It is true that the earliest manuscripts of the New Testament don't have names, don't have titles on them. Anybody, even without knowing a lot about manuscripts, do you see any reason why we might not be able to find names on these early fragments? You see any reason why? Let me just tell you that there's four ways you can put a name on an ancient manuscript. There's four ways. Number one is on a page at the beginning, which is much like what we do today. Second, and actually more frequent, is a name put at the end. Okay, it's more frequent to put a name at the end than at the beginning. The third one is that they would actually attach a name on a little piece of leather or wood on a string that would hang down. So you could just pull it off by that. Okay? The last one is that they would sometimes write it at the top of each page. Again, something that we do today. Those are the four ways. Beginning of the book, end of the book, top of the page, or a tag that is attached to it. Again, do you see any reason why he might be able to say truthfully but not completely accurately that these earliest fragments, these manuscripts, don't have any names on them? It's because they don't survive sufficiently intact for us to know if there was a name or not. No, there's no name on Papyrus 52 right here. There's no name on this. It's one tiny fragment that there could have been a name here, but we don't know. There could have been a name at the beginning of the manuscript. We don't know. There could have been a name at the end of the manuscript. We don't know. Could have been one of those tags on it. It could have been any of those. And so he can truthfully say that there is no name on it, but it's not because there wasn't a name originally. We just don't know. Same thing with Papyrus 104. Same thing in Matthew 21 that we have. Same thing with this one, Papyrus 90, also John 18. And you may be wondering about why on earth do I have a mummy mask up there? Why do I have a mummy mask up there? Well, there has been recently in a mummy mask, just understand for a second, you see all these beautiful golden mummy masks. You've seen those, and those are the famous and pop, but those are of kings. The ordinary people in Egypt made their mummy masks out of papyrus mache, can we say. They took old pieces of papyrus, put them in something to solidify them, and made a mask out of it and then painted it. Here's what it means. They're in those mummy masks, if you take them apart, there are fragments of texts. Okay? Now, there is a special process that has been used to separate these. It's the special process is called water and dawn. The dawn gives enough thickness to the papyrus for you to peel it off, and the water softens it down, okay? That's how it's actually done on that, in which they are beginning to peel these mummy masks apart and find fragments of texts in them. Now, one thing that seems to have been run across lately, and this is something where you'll see this in the news within the next year or so, they're still doing the study on this, but there is a fragment of Mark's gospel that they pulled out of a mummy mask. Now, they're still looking at what the date is on it. It's very, very early, but it's uncertain what the date is on this particular this fragment from this. But that's something that has been run across recently. But again, it is too fragmentary to the best of our knowledge to know whether it had a name on it or not. So what I want you to see is that it's true that the earliest fragments we have don't have any names on them, but that's because they're fragments. That's because they have not survived sufficiently intact. Here's what I do want you to see, is that as soon as manuscripts begin to survive sufficiently intact for there to be a name, there are names. I know that you may not be able to read this. The top of that up there, do you see the writing at the top, right up there at the top? It says Papyrus 66, 3rd century. There's some writing up there at the top. It says Euangelion Kata, and it's fragmented, but it says Ioannein, the Gospel according to John. It's what it says up there at the top in that. The John on this particular leaf is partly missing, but it's clear that it's there. This is an early manuscript. Another one. This is from Papyrus 4, which is a fragment. There's several different pieces. Papyrus 4, 64, and 67 all go together in this. That's what that one there is. It says here, Euangelion. Kata is kind of faded out. Matthion, Matthew, Gospel according to Matthew is what that says. As soon as they survive sufficiently intact for us to find a name, there is a name. So there's no good reason for us to deny that there might have been, that there were names in the... Now, we don't know for sure. I'm not going to claim any more than I can prove on the basis of manuscript evidence, okay? That's what he's doing that, and I'm not going to do that. I'm going to only suggest what we can claim on the basis of the real evidence of real artifacts we have, is that as soon as they begin to survive sufficiently intact to be names, they have the names. We do know that. That is absolutely certain. Now, here is what Ehrman suggests as the idea for how they got the names they've got, and this is where his argument falls apart. Here's what he says happened. You saw it earlier. So early second century, sometime in the first half of the second century, they decide that the books need apostolic authority, so they start putting names on the manuscripts to give them authority. Remember him saying that? They start putting the names on. Now, here's number one. If you're going to do that, are you really going to choose Matthew, Mark, and Luke? Now, first off, if you're going to fabricate a name, Matthew, he's in the background in the Gospels for the most part. If you're going to fabricate, Mark is not one of the apostles at all, though he was known to be with Peter, and Luke was a companion of Paul. Why not just say Paul, Gospel according to Paul, if you're going to make it up? Why not just say Gospel according to Peter if you're going to make it up? Why not say Gospel according to Andrew if you're going to make it up? If you're going to make something up, don't make it Matthew, Mark, Luke. And John is the only one that you could make a good case that somebody would fabricate that one. Okay? So first off, it falls apart, but here's where it really falls apart. Here's what Ehrman says happened. They started doing this in the early second century. But let me show you the geographic spread of the Gospels by the first half of the second century. Papias of Hierapolis, early second century, he's over here in Hierapolis in Asia Minor, okay? And he describes his knowledge of the Gospels. The Muratorian fragment we talked about earlier, that comes from over in Rome. That one's there. Now, this one, it isn't survived completely and sufficiently intact for us to know if it had a title, but it's all the way down in Egypt. Now, help me understand something, okay? Think through with me. If the Gospels have spread that far and people start fabricating names for them, okay, what would we find in the manuscript evidence? All different names. Exactly. All different names. Because let's face it, y'all can't even get 100% vote in your church. Okay? I mean, I can't in my church anyway. Maybe you can. We as Baptists, we can't even get 100% vote in our churches. Do you seriously think that they are going to fabricate names spread that far apart with no internet, with no capacity to readily communicate, with no centralized authority in the church yet, and somehow they all land on the right names, the same names? You're going to have gospel according to Matthew one place being called gospel according to Andrew, and you're going to have another place called gospel according to Peter, and another place as gospel according to somebody else. That's what you would find in the manuscripts if they had done that. They had already spread by the first half of the second century. They've already widely spread. It's already gone too far for them to fabricate names that everybody comes to the same name. And here's what you find in the manuscript evidence, that the gospel we know as John's gospel always has John's name on it once it has a name. The gospel we know as Matthew always has Matthew's, nobody else. Mark, Luke, the same thing. There is no way they could get that level of consistency, but there is not one exception to what I'm describing. Not one exception. Of all these manuscripts that exist, there is not one exception where we have the wrong name on a manuscript. Do you see that? What that demonstrates to us is that when they got those texts, they already knew who they came from. Now, that may have been, it's possible that they told us, that as they passed them on, they told the story. So they may have passed on Matthew. I'll even give Ehrman the benefit of the doubt and say, okay, let's just say there really weren't names on there originally. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. But it could have been that they shared a story. They said, this gospel here that we're giving you, it comes from Matthew. And you're going to make a copy of it and give us back our original so that we can have it in our church. And we're going, so they told the story. That's possible. I think there were probably names on them from the beginning. But even if there weren't, it still doesn't prove his point. It still does not prove his point. And what he claims in one of his books that just recently came out, and once again, to me, no better, he does know better than this. This is simply a weak argument. He says the way we know that this has happened is he says there is variation in the copy in the names put on the manuscripts. There's variations in them. But they're not variations of name. I'm going to show you the variation we see. And this is actually almost the complete breadth of the variation. There's actually one other variant that we have at times. But it's this right here. This one says, Evangelion kata Ioannein, which is gospel according to John. That one just says kata Ioannein, which is according to John, without the word gospel. There's your variation. But it's still John. It's still John. Now, there's a couple of other variations you see that are, but none of them are variants of the author's name. None of them. Not one variation in the author's name. Ever. There's not there. It's simply they are not there, any variations in the author's names. So what you see clearly at that point is that early Christians knew from the beginning where the Gospels came from. And they came from people that they knew to be trustworthy, they knew to be eyewitnesses of the risen Lord Jesus Christ, or close associates of those eyewitnesses. Now, last one I want to look at together is this one right here. He says, the resurrection is a violation of what naturally happens. By the very nature of the canons of historical research, we can't claim historically that a miracle probably happened. By definition, it probably didn't. And history can only establish what probably did. Now, I want to pause for a moment and think. I want that to sink in. It's a little bit difficult at times as you think through this. I don't want to go into this part. It's actually, if you've ever heard of a guy named David Hume, it's actually just a variation of a guy named David Hume, something he said all the way back in the 1700s. It's like a short version of this, but I don't want to go into Hume. I can if you want me to, but I don't think you want me to. Just trust me on that. That's where it comes from. The resurrection is a violation of what happens naturally. You can't claim historically that a miracle probably happened because a miracle is improbable. Now, what he seems to be saying at that point is whatever happens most frequently is what we ought to expect to happen. You can't say something that is infrequent happens in any sort of way that we would consider to be probable. Now, here's a reasonable response that I want to give. Multiple independent witnesses testified to the reality of the resurrection These accounts agree in details that are unlikely to have been fabricated. I want to unpack for a little bit how we actually determine what probably did happen in history. What probably happened. Now, as we're thinking about this, I want to prep your mind for this. I want to point out the fallacy of saying that something is improbable just because it rarely, if ever, happens. Okay? I want to pause right there. I want to think about the fallacy of that. Saying it's something I've never witnessed this happening, nor does anybody I know witness. This is something that is so rare that it is inconceivable that it could have happened, and so therefore it must be improbable. I want to tell you about something that is one of my favorite historical events ever, and it's one I bet you haven't even heard of. It happened in the 1800s, the late 1800s, 1867, and it happened 2 hours straight east of my house in Kentucky. It is called the Kentucky Meat Shower. I am totally not making this up. I promise you. You can look this up afterwards. And so the Kentucky Meat Shower. A woman is out hanging laundry on her line, and she turns around and sees meat falling from the sky, chunks of meat falling from the sky. And they go and they spread out over, just scatter over the space of a football field. She's pieces of meat. Now, I call that blessing. I mean, you just got meat falling from the sky. That's just a prelude to a barbecue, okay? That's what you do. You just crank out. If that happens to me, if the meat starts showering, I'm just cranking up the grill and we're throwing it on, okay? That's what's happening at that point. But it happens, and it lasts for about a half hour. Chunks of meat fall from the sky. Now, people come out and see this spread out over this football field-sized area. People by the dozens come out. The New York Times sends out a reporter who gets a report on this. This is a big deal that a lot of people are really interested in, and everybody's speculating about what happened. Some of them say, remember, they don't have a lot of a knowledge of space at this time, so they think maybe out in space there's meat and that just floats around out in space, and some of it fell through. One of the explanations was maybe there were two men fighting with knives, and a cyclone came along, and they just chopped each other up in the cyclone. I mean, they are speculating about what happened because dozens of witnesses come out, and there's meat scattered all over for space of a football field in her yard. And they're like, it's right now, it's the site of the Mudlick grocery store. Just so you know, if you look at the Mudlick grocery store out there, that's where it happened at. But 2 hours east of Louisville. Now, let's say that by his evidence, by his standard of being improbable, that could not have happened. That could not have happened. There's no way it could. Now, here's the other twist in this. All of that meat is now at Transylvania University at jars and in jars, and they still have it. Still there. So if in case you're really wondering and really want to look at it, the science department at Transylvania University has this, has all this stuff. They went and gathered it up. One guy, he was a mountain man, a former mountain man, it talks about. He went out and he picked up a piece of it and bit into it, and he said, "That there is bear." I mean, I could just imagine this guy in Kentucky. You know, he's hold my beer, that's bear. Okay, that's So that's what happens in this. Now, by his standard of probability of what probably could happen, that event could not have happened. But there are witnesses to it. There are artifacts from it. There's everything there. And this event happened. Now, to this day, here's the best explanation anybody's come up with for this event, okay? There is a certain species of vulture that if frightened will regurgitate, will vomit, and to get up higher, okay, to fly higher. And that the only explanation anybody's come up with is an entire flock or whatever it'd be called. Is that a murder of vultures? I'm not sure what it's called, of a group of vultures. But a group of vultures had feasted on something, then were frightened all at the same time by a hawk or something like that, and they all threw up to get higher. To this day, that's the best explanation anybody has for this. That's the best one anyone has at this point, still to this day, for this event from the 19th century that was well-known and well-reported and well-testified in the 19th century, okay? That's the best explanation somebody's got. Is vultures throwing up. They have done tests on it and found that it was goat lungs was what a lot of it that they tested was. So who knows on that? I don't know what happened. Maybe it was meat from outer space. I don't know. I don't really think it was. But But my point is that that shows the fallacy of what he's saying in terms of probability. Because we don't do history based on probabilities. We do history based on testimony and evidence, okay? So there's a falsehood right there. There's a false analogy, a false use of logic at that point that that's not how we do history. Otherwise, the Kentucky meat shower could not have happened. And like I said, look it up when you get home. Look it up and read all about the Kentucky meat shower and all of these different reports you're going to find from all these different newspapers in the 19th century, all having sent reporters there and actually witnessed this grand, glorious event, my favorite event in all of history, the Kentucky meat shower. So how do we actually determine what happened in history? Well, number one is multiple sources. If one person says it happened, it might have happened. It's not to say it didn't happen, but it's to say we rely on it more if multiple people reported it. But not only multiple, but multiple independent. That they're telling the story slightly differently, but even though they're slightly differently, they're telling the same story. Witnesses with nothing to gain. Now, somebody can tell a story and tell it truly if they have something to gain. It's not to say it would be false, but it's to say we're going to find it more believable when the person telling us has nothing to gain by what they're telling us. They have nothing to gain by that. Sources that are contextually credible. Contextually credible. Now, let me give an example to help understand. That's a little bit more difficult. If I told you that I ate an iguana for lunch today, okay? You're probably going to think, I don't think that's what you ate, okay? Now, that's not because I've actually never eaten an iguana. In fact, in the Bajo Aduan in Honduras, you can get fine, wonderful iguanas that you cook over the fire, and they are nice, like chicken, but sweeter meat. Iguana is good meat. So that's not because it's not edible, okay? They're good meat. They're really good to eat. But I didn't have one this afternoon. Why? You know that. Because it's not contextually credible. That's contextually credible on the east edge of Honduras, okay? To eat an iguana. That is not contextually credible on the east edge of Tennessee. Okay? It's not contextually credible. It doesn't fit with what we see and know about the place where we actually are. Okay? That's another way that we know that we can determine what happened. Testimony recorded while eyewitnesses are still alive. Internally consistent sources. These are six basic ideas that help us understand how we do history. Not the only ones, but they're really good, pretty general good guide as to how we do history. I want us to apply each one of these to the New Testament, to the gospel specifically. Multiple sources. I showed you this morning the multiplicity of sources. You saw that this morning about the resurrection. But also in the gospels themselves, there are multiple sources there, aren't there? There's more than one. Sometimes we get nervous about the differences between the Gospels, but actually we should be excited by the differences between them. The fact that they tell the same story from a slightly different way, that if you were making it up, you would have made the story match better. Like if they were making up, John would match better with Luke if they were making it up. But it's got some awkward spots that don't fit well, which says that somebody is telling the story not to try to fit another story, but they're trying to tell the story as they've received it. That's independent sources. Witnesses with nothing to gain. Did anybody of those that wrote the Gospels and proclaimed them have anything good to gain from them? No. There's nothing good to gain. There's everything to lose. They had no capacity to gain power through what they were doing. They had no capacity to gain money through what they were doing. They had no capacity to gain anything except for death. And yet they said it. They wrote it. Sources that are contextually credible. I want to tell you something, which one, I could give you a dozen examples, but I'll give you one example of this. So there are certain names that were used frequently in Judea, Galilee, among Jewish people. Okay? Jewish people used certain names frequently. They did not have a lot of variety in baby names. They needed a baby name book. They seriously did. Because every firstborn daughter was almost exclusively named Mary or Miriam, some form of Mary or Miriam. Secondborn daughter was almost exclusively named Salome or Shalom, which means peace. Okay? That's just one of those. The most frequent names are Jesus, John, Joseph, Simon. Those are all the most frequent names, only in that region, only in that area. Here's what's interesting. If the Gospels would have been written without having any access to information from the area where the events happened, they would probably have picked up the wrong names, so to speak. Names from the context where they were instead of the context where the events happened. If you're writing in Rome, such as Mark probably wrote his gospel in Rome, if you're writing in Rome and you are trying to draw together something to start a new religion and get it kicked off and do this gospel according to Mark that's going to be a bestseller, if you're trying to do that in Rome, you're not going to get the right names for Judea. Just not. But here's what a scholar named Richard Bauckham has done. He ran the stats of the frequency of names in the Gospels, and then he went and found all the burial places from which we have names in burial plots in Judea. And do you know what? They match exactly in terms of name frequency, the percentage of names. You can't fabricate that. That indicates these Gospels actually came from traditions that originated in those areas. Because they didn't have the capacity to go back and do that burial plot data. And they didn't have the capacity to run this on computers like Richard Bauckham did to match those up. But they match up. They match up. That, what is that? That's a source that's contextually credible. It makes sense in the context from which it is coming. Testimony recorded while eyewitnesses are alive. We already talked about that. Everything in the New Testament was finished while eyewitnesses were still living. And internally consistent sources. That is to say that the sources internally, they tell a story that seems that what they're bringing together fits together internally within each of the Gospels. Now, as you've seen this already this morning, I wanted to show you how this fits in this particular context and in this particular looking at this. This works especially for the resurrection. Multiple witnesses, independent witnesses, recorded while eyewitnesses are still alive. The first three certainly written down, probably not the fourth one, that they're written while eyewitnesses are still alive. As I've described, contextually credible sources through the names and through other things. Internally consistent sources, even though they say things from different angles, they say things in a way that there's certain facts that remain the same in each one. And sources with the people had nothing to gain based on what they wrote. I think on that, we can be unashamed of the gospel we have. That's what I want us to see. We can be unashamed of this. There is good history sustaining what we profess. It's good history. It's not merely good literature or good religion or good faith. It is good history. I will be honest, I would not. But there have been a couple of times in my life when I was younger where I would have had nothing to lose to walk away from the faith. And yet I honestly could not get around, when I was 17, 18, 19 years old looking at this, I could not get around the resurrection of Christ. That there's too good of a history sustaining it for me to be able to dismiss it and deny it out of hand. I could not do it. I cannot do it. And if that makes sense, if that happened, then the rest of this makes sense as well. If that didn't happen, nothing makes sense. Nothing makes sense. And here's what I do want to bring as we bring to a close. We've talked a lot about the history of the Bible, the history of the Bible. But I do want to make sure you see this and take this to heart. By the year 8200, the Bible, as far as we can tell, was in about seven languages. By 513, 17, 8, so we go all the way through. Last stats we have reliably are 2016. 2,426 languages have some portion of the Scriptures. That's great. But I want us to understand that more than 1,800 people groups have no access whatsoever to even a single word of Scripture. I've talked a lot today about why we can trust the Bible, and we should. But I want us to have a burden in our hearts for the fact that these truths that we have talked about today, there are 1,800, not 1,800 people, 1,800 complete people groups that do not have even one word of the Bible in their language. Not even a single word in their language. That should not be. We are still, and it's not bad or wrong, what I'm getting ready to describe, we are cranking out English Bibles and English translations literally by the millions of Bibles and by the dozens of different translations. And it's not wrong, but it's imbalanced when there's a significant portion of the world that has zero access to Scripture whatsoever. None. They have none. 1,800 people groups comprising between 160 and 180 million people have zero access to even a word of Scripture in their language. What it should do, our confidence we have in the Bible, what that should drive us to is a passion to say, how are we going to fix this? What are we going to do to fix this? And it helps because you drive us to seek ways through places. There are places that do this. Wycliffe Bible Translators is one group that does that, and there are others as well. How are we going to reach the world with the Word? How are we going to do that? 1,800 people groups, no Scripture. What are we going to do about that? We are confident and joyful in the text, and we should be. Let that confidence and joy drive us to seek ways that we can bring the Word to people who don't currently have the Word. Let's make sure we do that. Look for ways to do that. Look for ways to seek that out. Anyone have any questions about this last segment or about earlier segments, things you've been stewing over for a while? Yes? Yes, and I would encourage you to look at what they're doing. They're the ones who are doing it in the most rapid fashion at this point. They're doing that. Anybody else? Questions? As I said earlier, if you don't have a question, you're communicating to me that everything is crystal clear in your mind. Go ahead. Yeah, so they didn't recognize Jesus on the walk to Emmaus, why is that? There's some that would speculate that there was a supernatural reason they didn't. Chief veiled himself. I think what we're seeing in that is the degree to which they honestly didn't expect to see him again. They didn't expect to see Jesus alive, and so you, in some sense, you see what you expect to see. And I think there's a truthfulness that gives us about the resurrection accounts that supports them that they weren't expecting it. They were not expecting it. And if I want to dig in a little bit deeper, and this is from drawing from a man named N.T. Wright in his book, The Resurrection of the Son of God. He points out that the Jews could not conceive of a resurrection apart from everybody being resurrected. In other words, they thought when people are resurrected, is everybody's going to be resurrected, okay? It was very much out of what they would have expected to have a one-man resurrection. That was completely out of their capacity to think of, which actually goes to support even more the history of the resurrection, because of the fact that in the history of the resurrection, something that the Jewish people didn't expect is what happened. They would never have expected a one-man resurrection. And so sometimes people say, well, you know, they were expecting a resurrection, the Jews were. They were expecting a resurrection of everybody, of the world, of God to make things right and resurrect all the dead. They had no expectation of a one-man resurrection. And I think that's why they didn't recognize is this is not anything that was in their realm or breadth of expectations in that context. Yes? And Paul even picks up that first fruits language, that this one-man resurrection was the first fruit that points forward to a future resurrection, yeah, that is yet to come. Yeah.
Captivity in Babylon, mm-hmm. were probably the most literate group of people within the Roman Empire in the first century.
Yes.
Is there evidence for that?
That is something there's continuing debate on, and so there's two sides to that debate. One saying that so you've got a man named Birger Gerhardsen and some others who said basically, look, this system that we do know existed in the 200s and 300s AD, that couldn't have just emerged instantly. Okay, this system, this very clear rabbinic system with memorization and literacy, that had to have some precedent earlier. Okay. And so there had to be a higher level. So that's one. A guy named Alan Millard also has written a book called Reading and Writing in the Time of Jesus. Similar line of argument there. So that's one side. The other side is saying, no, even in that, they may have been able even to read it, but they couldn't actually write. At that time, there's mixed literacy and only a literacy of anywhere from 3% to 8%. That's an ongoing debate that is actually a raging scholarly debate, even now on that right there. I tend to think it's actually probably something somewhere in between. Those, I don't think it was as high a level of literacy as you get post 70 and post the Bar Kokhba rebellion in the a little bit later on. I don't think you have as strong a literacy during the time of Jesus as you do as you start having then. But I do think it's much higher than the 3% to 8% that has been estimated by other scholars who are basing it on the Roman Empire as a whole and not recognizing the unique dynamics of a Jewish faith, which was a textual faith. At that point. So they have a much stronger reason to hold on to a text. Yeah. Other questions? The what now? I've not had enough time to look at that. I've actually got read that, so that's a good thing. Yeah, I want to read about that more before I comment on that. Kind of like the mummy mask when I was like, I'm going to read a little bit more. Yeah. Anybody else? Questions? Yes.
Can I put you in contact with other pastors in New Mexico and Minnesota?
Sure. If you want, yes, I think so. No reason not to on that. So, yeah.